It's time now for Bucks Blue with your host, Lower Makefield Chief of Police, Joe Kelly, brought to you by Jammer Doors.
And welcome to Bucks Blue, June 2025 on WBCB, 1490 AM, 107.3 FM. Stephen, today we have on a guest who's got a storied police career. Russ Swope grew up in the world of law enforcement. Like many of our guests in the past, he is the son of a police officer. He joined the Washington, D.C. Police Force upon graduating from the University of Maryland in 1972. Over the 43 years, he rose through the ranks, ultimately becoming deputy chief of the D.C. Metropolitan Police. And then later had service in both the United States Mint Police and chief of police for the United States Supreme Court. His many responsibilities included planning, administration, management, investigations, budgeting, and human relations, with an emphasis on leadership. The chief is a highly effective law enforcement manager and a forward thinker. He pursued continuing education and applied it in every position he served. In addition to his numerous awards and commendations, the chief holds three master's degrees, one in applied behavioral science, one in justice and law and society, and the other in criminology. Following his retirement from the Metropolitan PD, Chief Swope, as I indicated before, served with both the United States Mint Police and the U.S. Supreme Court Police. He's published locally, nationally, and internationally on such topics as community policing, problem-oriented policing, leadership issues, effective policing strategies, and he's generally recognized as the creator and author of a seminal work on police ethics. He's currently working on a book where his proven approach to improving law enforcement and restoring an emphasis on trust, confidence, and cooperation with police. His book I'm reading now, Ethics-Based Policing, the chief presents a clear guide for solving the problems by focusing on seven building blocks of integrity: prudence, trust, courage, intellectual honesty, justice, responsibility, and self-effacement of interest. Chief, with that very, very short introduction, welcome to Bucks Blue.
Well, I'm happy to be here, Joe. I couldn't be more pleased.
And I appreciate you taking the time. Why don't we start where we normally start, and that's back in the beginning. So could you describe how growing up in a law enforcement family helped shape you professionally and personally?
Well, my dad was a D.C. policeman, and in the police profession, there's a tremendous amount of solidarity there. There was then, when I was growing up, there was when I was in it, and I think it's still there now, a lot of solidarity. There's comradeship and friendship, and we socialized when I was growing up with a bunch of fine men of courage and humanity and empathy, and they were family men, and they weren't prone to violence, but when it was necessary, they exercised it. And I was profoundly influenced by these fine men, especially my father. And I was drawn to that profession. And upon graduating from Maryland in business, I'd worked my way through college, and I sat in an office and doing draftsman's work, and I wanted to get out and do what these fine men did. They made a difference, even if it was a little, when they made a difference. And I wanted to be one of them, and I wanted to be one of the best of them. So I graduated from Maryland, went on the police department, and my mother cried because she knew my father got hurt, and everybody else that we socialized with was hurt from some point to another. And I went in and joined up, and it was the best move I've ever made in my life. The best move.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Everything about it.
Yep.
Everything about it.
Some of the cops I know who had long careers like you and still look back fondly, I think those are the best careers, well spent.
The rewards that I received, not medals and money, it was the intrinsic rewards that I received by helping people that were the most in need. And I was successful in doing that. And the people under my charge, as I rose through the ranks, adopted my mantra.
So the
they helped.
You came on in a time in the early 1970s. I entered law enforcement in the mid-80s, and I had a college degree, and people looked at me suspiciously because it was just becoming the norm. But I imagine in 1972, you were like a four-leaf clover coming on with a degree from the University of Maryland.
This is what happened. So there were 5,000 police officers on the Metropolitan Police when I joined. I was one of 10 out of 5,000 that had a college degree. So I remember I graduated at the top of my class in the academy. I'm going to roll call. I'm working. My first tour of duty is midnight, so I'm there 11:30 at night. And this old salty sergeant comes in and said, "Hey, what are you doing here, college boy?" So I was the college boy for a number of months. A sidebar is that this old salty sergeant, 13 years later, I'm a captain assigned to his district, and guess who I meet? And he says, "Hey, Captain Swope, good to see you. Glad you're coming back." I said, "You don't have to call me Captain Swope. Just call me Captain College Boy." I just left it at that.
So he must have remembered who you were, right?
He remembered who I was. Yes, I'm sure he did. But it was different back then. I mean, nobody had college degrees, and I was sort of a black sheep there, so they didn't have anybody to put me with my first night there. There were no radios back then. We used call boxes, and he says, "Here's your beat, 13th to 15th, T to W." That's the part of the city, and it was the salty part. It was the worst part, because that's what I requested, to go to the most active district in the city, and that's where I went. And that was my first tour of duty.
So let's explore that a little bit. I don't think a lot of our younger listeners are familiar with the call box. I have a picture of a New York City police officer on a call box in 1937 that prominently hangs in my office. But why don't we share with our listeners what a difficult communication path a young police officer had back when the call boxes were in effect, how they worked.
Well, they had call boxes about every six blocks throughout the whole city. That was your only way of communicating at the time. So you had this brass key, and you'd go to the call box and check in every hour unless you had something else going on. So there were no radios. Even in the cars, the radios weren't portable. They were stuck in the car. And when you made a traffic stop and got out, you put the PA system on so that you could hear the radio. But you walked I walked a foot beat in the roughest parts of town by myself with no radio. And if I arrested somebody, which I did, I'd have to put him in handcuffs and walk him to a call box unless there was another officer driving by in a car and he'd seen me and pull over. But there was a lot of police then. And generally, if you got into difficulty, you would be found. Either a citizen would call or they'd see you engaged in some problems. And they would stop. They would always call. So it was different back then. So I don't know, a year later, we got PR-25s, and we could carry those, but they could only you couldn't transmit from those. So you would hear what was going on, and then I guess a year after that, they got regular two-way radios that you could carry. But back then, the first couple of years I was there, there was no communication.
So essentially, that first radio you had, you're the first person to ever tell me about this. It essentially operated like a scanner, I'm guessing, right? You could hear what was going on, but you couldn't participate.
Right, you couldn't transmit.
Wow, that's fascinating. And tell me about you're on a foot post for how long before you get moved to a car?
Well, once we got the radios that I could receive, things started happening because when I was out there, I was out there to work. I wasn't out there to slack off. So I'd hear a call go out, there's a fire in this block and a house fire, and I'd run down there. And other cars would pull up and see me there, and the sergeant would pull up and see me, and I said, damn, I never seen that before. Somebody going to something without being ordered to. And then other times, you know, a crime would go out, and if it was on my beat, I'd beat the cars there, and I'd be taking the report, and the sergeant would come up, and they were like, damn, this is pretty good. So I sort of got, I guess the sergeants liked that, because it was unusual, I guess, to them. And so 3 years deep, they have an opening for detectives. So I take the test. I go through the oral board. And my sergeants must have gave, no, they did give me a great recommendation that I'm a self-starter. I do what needs to be done. I do things thoroughly. And I'm a detective in 3 years, which was shocking to me and everybody else. But my whole life in the service of my profession has been to do the very best that I can. Not just do the best, but to exceed all expectations, because I wanted to be the best, one of the best, just like those men that I grew up with. And that's what still motivates me to this day. I pursue excellence.
Well said. Why don't we take our first break here, Chief? When we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit more about policing the nation's capital.
All right.
Capital Health's primary care network continues to grow, bringing its extensive option of locations to your neighborhood. Whether you're scheduling a wellness checkup or not feeling well, advanced medicine starts with a Capital Health primary care doctor at locations near you in Mercer, Bucks, and Burlington counties. To find a Capital Health primary care location that's convenient for you, visit capitalmedicalgroup.org. That's capitalmedicalgroup.org.
Insurance can be very confusing and costly. That's why it's very important to choose the right insurance agency. Nottingham Insurance in Yardley and Hamilton is a fourth-generation family-owned insurance agency with over 100 years of experience. They'll find the best policy for maximum protection at the best price. Homeowners, business, life, auto, even flood insurance. Peter Toft at Nottingham Insurance will make getting your policies, including flood insurance, an easy and affordable process. Nottingham Insurance in Yardley and Hamilton. Visit nottinghaminsurance.com or call Peter Toft directly at 215-493-1996, extension 214. That's 215-493-1996. Extension 214.
We now return to Bucks Blue with Lower Makefield Police Chief Joe Kelly, brought to you by Jammer Doors.
And welcome back to Bucks Blue, June 2025, WBCB, 1490 AM, 107.3 FM. And of course, you can stream from anywhere in the world. We're on the phone with Ross Swope, who served multiple decades in the city, in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. And before we went to break, we were talking to the chief about some of his experiences. But one of the questions I had, it must be so interesting to police a city where history is made. During your 40-plus year career, were you on duty for any of these historical events, and do any jump out to you as some of the most memorable?
Well, there was a lot of events that I was...
I would imagine, right?
So, I was there for the Air Florida crash.
Is that the one? That's the one that went in the Potomac during the snowstorm?
Yes, okay. I was there for that. And I was there for every single major demonstration involving violence and civil disobedience. I was there for all the inaugurations, all the parades, all the trouble at the White House that is the epicenter for all demonstrations. And I was commander of Homicide Division. So I was in and out of investigations and uniform throughout my career. But I have to tell you, my heart lies with the uniform officer, the first responder. On all the TV shows, they have all the detective shows. I can tell you, those first responders are the men and women that need to be praised.
Couldn't agree with you more. The backbone of every police department.
Yes. I handled the double police homicide at the Capitol when Waverly came in and killed two police officers there. I handled that. I was commander homicide then. I handled that. Just everything that can happen. But I have to tell you something that I learned early on. There's three legs to my triad, and I pursued these relentlessly. One is experiential learning. Two is know the books in and out, general orders, policies and procedures, codes, municipal codes, traffic, ABC. I knew them all. And the third is higher education. So those are the three legs that put me where I am now. But getting back to what I saw, I learned early on that I don't like feeling uncomfortable. So my first demonstration as a new lieutenant, they sent me down to the State Department with 80 officers, and there was 5,000 down there acting up and said, go handle it. So I went down to the State Department. There were surely 5,000 there, and they were getting ready. I had 80 officers. I handled it and dispersed it, but I can tell you, I was not very comfortable. I did not like that. So it's like public speaking. Nobody likes it, right?
Right.
But if you do it often enough, it gets better every time. So I learned experiential learning is critical to me. So every single hot call that ever went out, I either went and took command or I went there and watched who was in command and assisted them. So 15 years deep, there isn't much I haven't seen or done because I put myself in those positions intentionally. So I would learn, have confidence, and be competent, which was critical to me and leading others. They knew if I showed up. They've seen me before. I've done these things. All turned out good. And there was a breath of relief for me and them. Now, a lot of my colleagues did not do that because it's risky behavior. It's risky business. Not physically dangerous, but career-wise. They think that what are my subordinates going to say? What are my peers going to say? What are my superiors going to say? Is it going to affect my performance evaluation? Is it going to affect my promotional opportunities? I do better if I just don't go, and they don't go, and they don't learn. So I worked the street the whole time I was on that department, and I had colleagues of mine at the same rank call me on the radio, switch to the command channel, and they'd say, hey, Ross, if the violent demonstration comes my way, can you slide by? Or, hey, Ross, I got a barricaded gunman up here. Do you think you can slide by? You know why they were doing that, don't you?
No confidence.
They haven't done it. They were scared and didn't know how to handle the situation. And I felt it was a disservice to not only their subordinates and the people they were leading, but to the community. Because if you don't know what you're doing, you're just another dumb cop. The only way you're going to learn these things is to get out there and do them. Get out of your comfort zone.
Excellent point. Excellent point. How did your experience at the U.S. Supreme Court Police differ from your experience at MPD? I mean, it's an extremely specialized agency that nobody really outside of it would know a lot about.
Well, they have their own police department because of the separation of powers in the government.
Okay.
They're the judiciary branch. They don't want to be controlled and can't be controlled by the Congress or the executive branch. So they have their own police department. Now, I was there. It was a sleepy little guard force when I went there, but I spent over a decade there making that into a first-class police department. Now, they provide protection for all the justices and the chief justice. They police the building. They do security. They do policing there, investigate crimes, and they travel all over the place with them, just like the Secret Service does with the presidency. So it was a little different. It was more protection. And, we had major demonstrations there, and we locked up big crowds, and I enforced the law, and made criminal arrests, but the thing that always concerned me is those are tough and dangerous jobs. It's hard to protect with over 500,000 guests at the court every year and the events that they have there and protecting the justices. It's a difficult job because you never know when somebody's going to come in there. Now, I was there, investigated the Capitol Police murders there when that guy went broke into the Capitol and shot two police officers. I know they can happen. I have seen it happen. So it's a dangerous job. I think it's just as dangerous as the first responders because you just never know and you have to be on your toes. You have to have your head in the game while you're there because it's dangerous. And I've seen those shootings. I've investigated them. And I applaud the work that they did. They did fine work.
And I imagine you had some FaceTime, probably at your rank, quite a bit with the justices themselves.
I did. I did indeed. They were all fine people, and I didn't always agree with their opinions, but that was neither here nor there. I was there to make sure that they could conduct and do their business in safety, and we did that. Not just me, but everybody that worked with me did.
Absolutely. I had the honor of meeting Justice Scalia one time when I was the commanding officer of Trenton Station in New Jersey, and he was getting off a train, and he had always been a justice I admired, so I was excited about meeting them, and they gave us the time his train would be coming in. So he got off the train, he put his bags down for a second, and I was with a police officer, and I grabbed a bag, and Justice Scalia said, "Lieutenant, put that bag down. You'll carry that bag when I'm dead and not until then." I said, I like this guy. He's a tough, tough man. And we walked up to his car, but that was my only contact. But what a brilliant man, just like they all are. It doesn't matter what side they lean towards. They're nine of the smartest jurisprudents you're ever going to run into, and it must have been just an honor to work with them every day.
Well, Justice Scalia, I sort of had a little bond with them. I mean, I didn't socialize with them. I was there to protect and serve them, and they knew that. But he was honored, and I'm honored, too. And he had all these things, and I'd go up and talk to him once in a while. And he'd smoke a cigar. I'd smoke a cigar with him and have coffee. But he was a fine man. And I investigated his death when he died in Texas. And so he was a fine man, yes, indeed.
So you worked, obviously, in a city police department that covers a district and also federal agencies. Over the course of your long career, what did you learn about institutional culture and its effect on officers that enter the department?
Well, 93% of the 17,000 police agencies in the United States do background checks. And they have all kinds of different exams to root out and eliminate people that aren't suited for police work. But in my book that you're reading now, you'll see that all the policies and procedures on ethics and good conduct coming from the top are all written down mostly from what I've seen. So you can have all those policies, procedures, and general orders on conduct, ethical behavior, and the way you're supposed to do things. But if those rules and regulations are not enforced by our ethical gatekeepers, by that I mean the last police supervisors and officials, so to speak, touch the mail, the people that work with the street officers and detectives every day, if they don't abide and follow those rules and regulations, then the culture develops itself. They don't guide, counsel, enforce, reward, and recognize things that are right and things that are wrong. They set the culture no matter what the policies and procedures say. And that's basically what my book is about. That there's got to be accountability for officers' conduct. And there's got to be the responsibility on the first line, supervisors and the mid-level managers, the sergeants and lieutenants, to see that that is done. That is what controls the culture. And if they don't take up the responsibility and hold subordinates accountable, the culture takes on a life of its own, which generally is not often good. Now, it's a two-pronged approach to that. You hold those who are not performing and doing their duty with ethics. There's consequences for that. The second part of that is those who are doing it are recognized and rewarded. And that's what sets the culture, because the rest of the people state, do I want to be held accountable with consequences, or do I want to be recognized and rewarded? That's what sets the culture. And yeah, you're always going to have maybe 5% that are slaps. You know what slap is, right?
Yep, I do. Yep.
Stupid, lazy ass police. Okay.
Up here, we call them. We call some of them rods, retired on duty.
Okay. Well, we call them slaps down where I came from. So anyway, you're always going to have those, but if it takes on a culture of its own down at the street level, then you've got 25 or 30 in out of 100. And that's not good for the department, your unit, or the community we serve. And it all can be fixed in-house, as I describe in my book. How this is done? We eliminate the use of excessive force, or reduce it so significantly. And I can tell you, Joe, I have done this my whole career, and I can tell you firsthand that it works. And I know it works. I guess back in the late 90s, Janet Reno, the Attorney General for President Clinton, was having a national three-day symposium on police integrity in D.C. So I was up at Hopkins at the time, and one of my professors told me about it, and I said, well, damn, that sounds interesting. And he hooked me up with the organizer, and I said, yeah, I'd like to come down. It's a powerhouse of people down there, of academics that I've read their books and other graduate courses that I've taken. And he said, none. I said, oh, okay, well, that sounds funny. No cops. These are all academics. They know everything. I said, okay. So I go down there on Sunday morning, and I read through the program, and it's a three-day program, and I go to it, and it says, Ross Swope, keynote speaker, Monday at 2 o'clock. So I go and grab him by the lapels and shake him. What are you doing? And he said, there was no cops. Have at it. You got an hour. So I take off out of that place like a scalded dog and go up to the station where a computer was, and I started thinking, what did I do for my past 15 years? And things are not like, they're good. They're real good. So I wrote down my speech, and it was called the Police Corps Virtue Bell Curve. So I give up and give my speech. I'm just a captain at the time. And so I get two claps, and not literally, but figuratively, sit down and shut up. So I did. So about that time, they had the L.A. Rampart Division corruption incident, and it went nationwide for a week. Basically, cops in L.A. were robbing drug dealers, reselling the drugs, keeping the money, beating people up, robbing them, even as far as a bank robbery. So they had the big scandal, and they did this big investigation. So I was in the office one day, and my clerk said, hey, there's assistant chief from L.A. here on the phone for you. And I pick it up and said, hey, how you doing? And he says, I'm good. I just wanted to give you a heads up. Oh, heads up about what? Well, we've just completed our 350-page Rampart Division corruption report. and you're featured prominently in there. And I said, I wasn't even there at the time. He said, no. So apparently Janet Reno published all the speeches in this book from the symposium, every speech given. And they got that book, and they found that while there was a lot of interesting comments in there, I, Captain Ross Swope, made the profound finding, and what he said is exactly what was wrong in LAPD. And that's our problem. And I was all in that book, and it just, you know, put me on the map. I taught ethics at Johns Hopkins in the graduate level, and I followed the seven core virtues that you enumerated at your opening. And those things were, I have seen it, other departments have used it. I've given lectures and talks all over the nation, and it can be done, and it is being done, and it's effective, it's proven, it's reliable, it's in-house.
Chief, if we could take a second break here. We come back, I want to talk a lot more about police ethics and some of the items in your book.
All right.
Capital Health's primary care network continues to grow, bringing its extensive option of locations to your neighborhood. Whether you're scheduling a wellness checkup or not feeling well, advanced medicine starts with a Capital Health primary care doctor at locations near you in Mercer, Bucks, and Burlington counties. To find a Capital Health primary care location that's convenient for you, visit capitalmedicalgroup.org. That's capitalmedicalgroup.org.
Insurance can be very confusing and costly. That's why it's very important to choose the right insurance agency. Nottingham Insurance in Yardley and Hamilton is a fourth-generation family-owned insurance agency with over 100 years of experience. They'll find the best policy for maximum protection at the best price. Homeowners, business, life, auto, even flood insurance. Peter Toft at Nottingham Insurance will make getting your policies, including flood insurance, an easy and affordable process. Nottingham Insurance in Yardley and Hamilton. Visit nottinghaminsurance.com or call Peter Toft directly at 215-493-1996, extension 214. That's 215-493-1996. Extension 214.
In your journey back to work, we understand the barriers you may face. We have a solution to bridge that gap. No matter your background, PA CareerLink staff are here to provide personalized assistance and help you thrive. Take the first step towards a new chapter in your career journey with PA CareerLink. Visit pacareerlink.pa.gov or your local PA CareerLink office today. Paid for with Pennsylvania taxpayer dollars.
We now return to Bucks Blue with Lower Makefield Police Chief Joe Kelly, brought to you by Jammer Doors.
And welcome back to Bucks Blue, June 2025. We are on the phone with our guest, Ross Swope. And before we left for a break, Chief, we were talking about ethics and some of the essence of it, police ethics. I know when I went to the police academy, they had a police chief come in that gave a brief talk on ethics. And in my opinion, and the opinion of many of my classmates, it was useless. They went over the price of a cup of coffee, and if you took a free cup of coffee every week, that you'd in essence be corrupt. Years later, when I was transferred to the training unit, I was fortunate enough to go to the Southwestern Law Enforcement Institute Ethics Train the Trainer course, and we learned a new way to teach new recruits and supervisors and FTOs how to really get through on the ethics lesson plan. And a lot of that was teaching ethical decision making. My question is, in regards to all this, do you think we're training both recruits, field training officers, and supervisors the proper way to be successful with ethical behavior in policing?
I think the most effective way, and I lay it out in my book, is we have to win the hearts and minds of the sergeants and lieutenants. They are the ones that have to see the significant benefits both personally, professionally, serving those subordinates, giving them proper guidance, and setting the culture, and it serves the community well. I have seen it. I talked to you about things that I did not read. I talked to you about things that I did and do, and things that I saw, and how to correct those things. So I'm not, I live this. I know it works. It is a success. So it's, we have to get the sergeants and lieutenants, and maybe it happens, into the program where they see the benefits of holding people accountable and rewarding and recognizing those that do the right thing all the time. For instance, I know something happened last night. I attended roll calls, even as a captain and a chief and a deputy chief. And if somebody did something right, I would make sure I was there the next day to call them out in roll call at a minimum and say, damn, that was good work last night. You did the right thing. And everybody saw and heard that. It wasn't monetary. It was just recognition, which is a powerful motivator. And that's the things that need to be done. If somebody does something blatantly wrong, you give them consequences for what they did. And so rookies coming out of the academy are a blank slate. They know all these things, but they're going to adopt the conduct and behavior, whatever the culture is, into the unit they go into. They're a blank slate. So you can set the culture. If it's good, they're going to excel. If it's bad, they're either going to be bad, they're going to do nothing, or they're going to leave the department because it's not right, and they see that. So that's the way I know it works. It works for me. It works for others. And everything I've written and talked about, they see it too.
And your comments resonate with me. I mean, I've had a lot of – I'm on my third job now where – my third department where I've been in a high command position. I spend a lot of time, as you've described, issuing rewards. And a lot of time that's nothing more than a pat on the back, addressing someone at roll call, a quick email saying you did a good job. And I think a lot of the police commanders that are experiencing challenges are not doing that. So I couldn't agree with you more on that. It's a lot more than just holding people accountable. It's showing that you also value and reward the behavior that makes you a success.
So I've got in my book, it's called the Police Rewards Continuum. And it's a ladder of things that you can do. So the first thing, an officer does a good job and you're on the scene, you just go up and give a pat on the back from a captain or whoever, sergeant, lieutenant. Damn, that was good work. I'm really proud of you. Thanks. And then it goes up to his performance evaluation. You put a note in his performance evaluation. Then it goes up to a minor written commendation, and it could go up to a major commendation, and it can go up to Officer of the Year. So there's a ladder of continuum depending on what they did right that you can use. Now, on the other side, there's consequences. It can be a sour look when they say something or do something. You know, if I'm there and somebody drops an F-bomb on a citizen, that person, that officer's not walking away without me saying, don't do that anymore. That's not right. So it's a minor talk up to a written reprimand, up to disciplinary action, and up to termination, and up to criminal charges. So there's two ways to do it. There's a reward continuum, and there's a consequence continuum. And there's a lot of exercises, as you know, that you can do. There's a lot of things you can do. You know that.
Absolutely. So let's talk about some of your building blocks of integrity, because they're really the core of your book. And some of them are fascinating. I've seen these notions before, but never framed this way. So let's start with prudence. Why is it such a challenge for officers to exercise careful judgment
in high-stress environments, and what can we do about making them better at that?
It's not a one-shot deal. I mean, if you're reading the book, you know the problems with policing goes back to the 19th century.
Absolutely.
With the corruption and excessive force and the payola and everything else that goes on. And, you know, going back to the Napkin Mission with Serpico, it was going on there. And the Napkin Mission did this and all these changes. Well, it repeats itself. We learn and we put a Band-Aid on it. And for some reason or another, they think it's fixed because they put a Band-Aid on it and it's going to go away and never come back again. It's in my study and in my experience, it has to do with the culture. You set the good culture, you don't have these problems. If you have a laissez-faire sergeant that doesn't want to do anything, the culture develops into itself. If you have a Mr. Popularity sergeant that doesn't hold anybody accountable unless he's forced to, or writes commendations and rewards for everybody, even though the slackers are getting them, it means nothing. If you have an ethics-based official running it, everybody knows what to do, where he's coming from, and to do the right thing. Those are the ones that set the culture, and if we can get the sergeants to do that, I can tell you firsthand from experience and from feedback I've gotten from other departments that this truly does work. It works.
Prudence
with good judgment is, when I say hold, when I say build a culture, it's not a one-shot deal. That's the way the culture is set. It's ongoing every single day. The sergeant goes in, says, did a great job, there's rewards, recognition. Everybody sees that. They want to be part of that. The bad ones, like I said, you're probably going to have them so you can get rid of them. But there are going to be consequences for them, and everybody's going to see that. The culture is there every day. You reinforce them. Reinforce it every day. And roll call, talks, informal talks, everything is the totality of that exercise, the totality of building that culture. And it's not a Band-Aid. It's an ongoing process where everybody knows what they're supposed to do, and when they have to make a judgment call, they think about things, and they take care of it. They think about it because that's what the culture is. The decision-making officer thinks about it. This guy punched me in the mouth. I fought him, and I stopped when the threat stopped. I didn't keep on beating him up, even though I was angry and hurt. I stopped my use of force when the threat stopped. That's part of an ethical culture. You stop when the threat is no longer there. You just don't keep beating somebody up.
Well said. And if we could take our last break, when we come back, I want to continue with the building blocks.
All right.
Capital Health's primary care network continues to grow, bringing its extensive option of locations to your neighborhood. Whether you're scheduling a wellness checkup or not feeling well, advanced medicine starts with a Capital Health primary care doctor at locations near you in Mercer, Bucks, and Burlington counties. To find a Capital Health primary care location that's convenient for you, visit capitalmedicalgroup.org. That's capitalmedicalgroup.org.
With over 7,200 square feet of 200 brewers in stock at all times, Pat Theon Beverages now features five different flavors of their favorite slushy cocktails. You can also purchase all your wine, liquor, and other fine spirits right next door. Visit us on Facebook or online at pattheonbeverages.com for upcoming events and samples from your favorite brewery or local food vendor.
We now return to Bucks Blue with Lower Makefield Police Chief Joe Kelly, brought to you by Jammer Doors.
And welcome back to Bucks Blue, June 2025, WBCB, 1490 AM, 107.3 FM. And we are on the phone with Chief Ross Swope talking about police ethics and and how we can improve police ethics. Before we went to break, we were talking about prudence. Chief, I'd like to bring something up that many lay people probably don't think about. But when they think of police courage, they always think of physical courage, being able to run in and take risk physically. Can you talk about the relationship of the core value of courage and a pillar of ethical decision-making and how it's used in policing?
So, courage, I agree. You have to have courage for physical events. But a lot of things are in police work take courage because... And if I had a nickel or every time somebody said, I'll have your badge for this, I'd be a rich man. But sometimes it takes courage to do the right thing. For instance, an officer's called to a grocery store, and they had a stand of pickles there. And this lady was there with her two children, and one of the kids bumped into the thing and knocked it over and broke a lot of jars of pickles. So he calls the police. And I happened to be around that. So I went there, and he wanted the lady to pay for him. And I said, what was going on? These kids were here, and they bumped into it and broke them all. So if I came in here and did that, would you want me to pay for them all? And then I'd say, well, you want me arrested for destruction of property? And he would say, yeah. And I would say, well, we're not doing that because it was an accident. The officer is behaving ethically when he says, we're not taking a report. I'll take a report of damage to property, but I'm not taking a destruction of property, which is a criminal offense, because there was no criminal intent. So he's with his big store manager, and he's trying to market him and tell him what to do. It takes courage to stand up and do the right thing. And this happens a lot. I mean, I've been in places where children were there in terrible, deplorable conditions. And I just take them up to youth division. I'm taking these kids. They're not staying here. It's dangerous. You're risking their lives. And, you know, there'd be crowds there, and they're taking the kids. It takes courage to do the right thing sometimes. Not physically, but you think about what's going to happen in my career. I got to listen to this guy. No, you do the right thing, and you're going to be taken. You're going to be covered because you're doing the right thing. So it's courage to do things, especially when you're facing things that are uncomfortable, never before encountered. But if you think back on those pillars, and you know what the right thing to do because you're in a squad or platoon or sector or district where these things happen every day and are common, and you know you've got confidence in your officials, but they're going to see you're doing the right thing, the ethical thing. That takes courage to do sometimes.
Agreed. And how does that play into? I mean, a lot of what you just described is handling things the right way with not only a legal mind frame, but also with a moral one. So how does that play into the police public trust and police public relations?
So you have empathy with people. You understand them. You are there to took an oath to protect and serve. And that's the critical part. If the public that you serve understands that you're empathetic, you understand, you listen, you are there to serve them, and you do that, then the community is going to trust you. Now, the way you do that is to interact with the community. You talk to them. I set up programs there where meet and greet, where I told officers to go out doing your tour of duty, stop in three places, knock on a door, introduce yourself. That goes a long way. It works. You build trust by behaving ethically, and the community sees this all the time. and they appreciate that, and they start to trust, and there's all kinds of benefits. I had a sergeant that worked for me, and he was out on the road all the time, and he'd get out of his car and walk around and talk to citizens. So eventually I got promoted to deputy chief and took over a homicide division. That sergeant talked to people. He'd come down and closed at least four cases just by talking to people, by walking around. He built trust. They trusted him. Four homicides were closed just on his information that we had nothing on. So there's benefits to the department and the community if you meet the people and empathize with them, understand them, think things through, and use good judgment. It takes courage. Yes, it takes courage sometimes, because sometimes it's not comfortable when somebody is demanding things from you, and you want to build a relationship with everybody.
Along those lines, has the body camera, body-worn camera, it probably came in, you know,
yeah,
into
it was,
mainstream.
It was coming in with, it was coming in when I was leaving. But
okay.
All the studies that I have read, its effectiveness for reducing misconduct is still undetermined. That's what I've read in the studies that I have read about the body cam. I have been filmed on YouTube countless times in mass demonstrations and making arrests. I've never had any problem with people taking pictures of me. They can take a whole movie of me. I have no fear of a camera. I'm doing the right thing. And when the occupiers came to the court, 5,000 strong, and I had 100 officers out there, we did battle. And they were all out there filming it. I was all over YouTube. I still am. And I didn't have any fear of them taking pictures of anything. I was doing the right things legally. And I had no fear of a camera, and I never did and never will. If you're doing the right thing, cameras don't make any difference to me. And hopefully they shouldn't make any difference in ethically performing officer.
I agree.
Now, yeah. I want to say one thing.
Go ahead.
So a lot of what's in that book is transferable to the other private and public sector positions. And my book is a bestseller on Amazon now, and I've had an influx in the past 6 months of civilians buying this book. And I'm glad that they are, because it helps them understand the police and the police operations. So to your listeners that aren't police persons or involved in that, it's an interesting read. And those who are police, they should check it out on Amazon.
And
we
only have a few minutes left, so I want to ask you one last question, because it may take a few minutes to answer it. But from your perspective, how do we ensure that we're, number one, hiring the most ethically sound police officers? And then number two, how do we ensure we're promoting? Because as you mentioned, and I agree, first line supervision is critical. How do we ensure that we're promoting the most ethical police officers?
Well, I think that the vast majority of all police agencies in the United States are doing a real good job in screening and selecting. I think that they weed out most of the undesirables. Not all, but they eliminate most. And they hire good people. The issue is once they get assigned. So as far as promoting sergeants and lieutenants, a written exam to me is important. And what I did was I had oral boards, and questions were asked on the oral board about ethics-based supervision. And they would ask them scenarios, what would you do here, what would you do there, what would you do here. And the other thing is performance ratings. So somebody's studying for sergeant, they go through a written test, they go through an oral board, and then there's a rating that their supervisors give them. And this rating should include something about ethical performance. So they get what I call a suitability ranking. So because it's suitability from supervisors, their captain and maybe lieutenant. The oral board, which talks about ethics and questions them about it, and the written test, so they know what the policies and procedures are on everything, but in particular, ethics and proper conduct while on duty. Those are the three things that I found when I developed, along with all of officials and officers in the Supreme Court, for a promotional process. And that worked well.
Those are all excellent points. And Chief, I can't thank you enough for coming on. Your work and your comments on ethical policing are spot on. I think your book, Ethics-Based Policing, available on Amazon, is a must-read for all police officers, not just for supervisory positions. And I wish you the best of luck going forward, and hopefully we can talk again soon.
Well, Joe, it was my pleasure being on here with you and talking to somebody that...
Hopefully we can talk again soon.
Well, Joe, it was my pleasure being on here with you and talking to somebody that understands our profession, and I hope that I helped your listeners understand a little more about police operations, and I know you do, and it was my pleasure being on your show, Joe. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, and stand by for Yardley Borough On Air with Mayor Chris Harding.
Handcuffed.